Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words with Emily Burke and a man to my left who is actually going to be quiet for about 4 minutes, Jason Hollis.
It's going to be a great day, guys. It's a good episode. It's nice outside. I didn't wake up totally tired today, so it's a good vibe in here.
That was your longest intro yet.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of you. You're becoming yourself and you're coming out of your shell. So let's get to Jason Hollis, who is the very first person that has ever done like kind of like a vlog in the studio with his camera, which I liked. And I swear he did not almost fall down the stairs. That did not happen. But he is dressed better than all of us ever have combined. And he's a punk aristocrat. He's not a pink spider, but he's worked with them. What else? Tell us some more about him before he talks about himself.
He's a very nice guy.
He is.
I just met him today, but he's lovely.
I've met him. This is the second time we met, and we actually booked a time for our wedding next year. So it's going to be a really, really special day. My wife is totally cool with it. I'm kidding.
She's the ring bearer?
She is actually the ring bearer and the flower girl. Mm. She's very tolerant, you know? Actually, you know I'm ordained, so the one question they asked me when I became an ordained minister was, do I support same-sex marriage? And I said yes. And I'm like, okay, bro, you're ordained.
All right, cool. That's all it takes?
Apparently in some areas. In okay. Some areas it's probably, do you support same-sex marriage? Yeah, no, you're not ordained. Can't do it here. We don't like your kind. It's weird that in certain northern areas like Montana, they have southern accents.
I've never thought about it. And I've never been to Montana.
And now you're never going to stop thinking about it. And yeah. I've been to 44 or 45 states. Montana is not one of them. Anyway, who are the next few guests on the show? And then we're going to dip into the beauty and the grace that is Jason Hollis.
Well, I have a little list on my phone. And it's actually...
You're prepared?
Towards the end, though, because I only have one name left on it. And that's Chris Foytel.
Chris Foytel. Let's talk about Chris Foytel very briefly, in addition to the fact that you work kind of for him.
I'm not in his department, but Chris Foytel is A&R over at Epitaph Records, and he brought in apples last week, and they were really good.
Were these apples in stereo? No. I got a laugh from the guy on my left. We're going
to
win.
I'm trying not to talk.
Well, you succeed. No. Chris Foytel, I've known him for quite some time. Actually, when my old band, The City Drive, was shopping for labels, and he was an A&R at Epic. And then he was A&R at Atlantic, and then he was A&R at Fearless, and now he's A&R at Epitaph. And all those labels are really great, but Epitaph is my favorite label of all time, so this is going to be a really, really cool show. Who else do we have?
By default, it's mine, too.
Well, you work there, so legally you can't say otherwise. Who else do we have?
That was the last one on my list.
Mm.
But I believe...
Making me pull up my... Well, we rescheduled Mara. Mara from Superior Music Publishing.
And then I believe we're going to have a guy from another band.
Well, possibly. I've been trying to avoid those stupid band dudes because they don't know anything about anything. But we have this guy named Ben Farber who works at Pandora coming on the show. And let's give one more shout out to the upcoming guest before we talk about Jason Hollis for about 33 hours because that's the length of this show. So if you're listening and you're as tired as I am, it's great because you're going to be listening to Jason Hollis a really long time. Okay, so we've got Dave Bogan who I think he knows more about this industry than anyone I know. But he runs this group on Facebook called Artist Management Collective, and he is a professor at a UCLA class regarding the music business. So I think we're actually going more in the direction of learnage instead of talking about people who don't know how to tune a guitar.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
I don't know how to tune a guitar, and I'm on the show, so
yeah, but
there's hope for everybody out there, you guys.
I was not insulting you. I was saying that musicians are. You're not a musician. You're just a musician awesome.
Thanks.
So say one adjective about what you think this Jason Hollis interview is going to be like, and then we're going to interrogate the fuck out of him.
Energetic.
Whoa. The adjective I was going to use was sincerity.
Oh.
Ah!
Sweet.
All right, so stick around, enjoy these commercials. Every single Tuesday night, 5 p.m. Pacific time, 8 p.m. Eastern time, Waldman's Words airs and reruns on Sunday mornings at 5 a.m. for you early birds or late night owls, 5 a.m. Pacific time, 8 p. No, not a.m. 8 a.m. Eastern time? Because I know that as a college student, Emily, you are totally waking up on Sunday mornings at the crack of dawn to listen to Walden's words.
Or just going to sleep. If I'm cool that night.
You're tough as fuck. Stick around. Hello. Welcome to Waldman's Words with two cups of coffee, one Emily Burke, one Jason Hollis, and yours truly.
Three Adderalls and a glass of whiskey.
Yep.
I mean, if we're going to start the show with non-illegal drugs, let's keep this up. This is going to be a good show. I'm learning a lot. I'm on speed. Emily.
Yeah.
You met Jason Hollis in the parking lot, and I think that that's a really good start to the story. What was that like?
It was nice. It's a beautiful day, like I said in the intro. So I have no complaints. It's a lovely parking lot. Some great people go in and out of it.
The tone of your voice every time you say things. She has resting bitch face for her voice. I've determined this. And the word nice, whenever a female describes anything as nice, I don't like it. Like,
I can't say nice. I can't say fine.
Fine is worse. Yeah. And interesting's even worse. Oh. What if like you proposed to a dude and he was like, sure.
If I'm the one having to propose, it is not the dude I would propose to.
Okay, that's fair. Anyway,
just going to do it caveman style. Just, we're getting married.
Yeah.
Marriage not good. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. And actually, I just watched Encino Man again. That movie is sick as fuck. And we're in the valley. All right, Jason. So how did we meet?
We met. I think that I praised you on Facebook.
Damn right you did.
And you said something, and I agreed with you, and I praised you on it and probably shared it.
We're both very pro-Trump. So yeah. That's exactly what happened. Great man.
It was something music-wise.
You mean Trump's klezmer album?
Yeah. And I think that's how it happened. You know, social media is a hell of a thing now. You know, it's interesting. One of my biggest idols is for my entire life has been this guy named Andrew Luke Oldham. And Andrew is the guy who discovered and managed the Rolling Stones for the first 10 years of their career. He literally, you know, put the band together and came up with the concept and the idea of like
a clearly unsuccessful concept.
If the Beatles are clean cut, you guys are growing your hair long. If they're using manners, you guys are saying, you know, fuck.
They're louts.
Yeah. And so Andrew is a really big friend of influence of mine. And through social media, I wrote a blog post. I was writing about a blog post about his book. And I just read his book called Stoned, and it was about the first 20 years of his life, and the first really the 10 years of the Rolling Stones. And I wrote this great write up about his book and everything. I put it on my website, and like 15 minutes later, I got an email, and it was like thanks for the review, and it was like dash A, and I wrote him back, and I was like, hey, thank you, or you know, are you a fan? And he was like, I'm Andrew Luke Oldham. And it was great. And since then, we've had this relationship. It's all been through social media, through email. We've had this exchange of like almost like a mentorship for the past 15 years now. We've been going back and forth. And it's crazy what social media can do, how it can, you know, put you in contact with
how Emily and I met.
It's like-minded folks.
Like-minded and unlike-minded folks. But yeah, I believe it was a Facebook message, and we met for a coffee tea. And shortly after, I was like, you know what? Actually, during, I realized that you knew your shit. You liked your shit.
Now, at what point when we first met did you realize you were underdressed?
Immediately after looking at you.
Right, yeah. Scott rolls in sweatpants. It's like, I just got out of yoga.
That's a really good Scott impression. And then Jason walked in like, motherfucker, motherfucker, bitch, I'm in a suit. Yeah, I was like, I just got out of yoga with my wife. This is me. I sell real estate. That's exactly what. Yeah, I was underdressed. And I actually wear shorts doing the show and a hat. And I'm super casual. But our meeting, I was just like, dude, like, I'm in yoga. And pretty much.
It's sad because he was wearing his wife's sweatpants, and they said pink on the butt.
It said PNK on the butt. Right. It's like juicy, and with morbidly obese people, the eye comes out, but yeah. It was in my crack. So yes. At any rate, yeah, no, I was beyond underdressed, and Jason is the opposite of that. I feel like he takes a shower in the outfit he's wearing right now, so it's pretty.
Take a shower before the outfit, but
what?
You know, here's the thing, right? First of all, I feel like we're in an industry that should be respected. It was set up.
I hope I wasn't disrespectful.
No. This is just this is my thought. I'm a firm believer in lead by example, right? But the people that I looked up to and that I studied, record producers and engineers and A&R people and songwriters and heads of labels, when you look throughout the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, you know, these people were dressed to the nines.
Ama Ergen was always wearing a suit.
Always. And there was a level of respect. George Martin, you know, he walked into the studio and they were in suits. It was a respect.
And bands would record in suits, too.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's something classy about that to me. And in an industry that is as self-destructive as we are and sometimes it's terrible. I think that, you know, as much class as you can bring to it through your inspiration or leadership or how you dress, it kind of changes the moods, sets the tone, and it kind of ramps things up a little bit more. So, you know, I just kind of tip the hat every day. There was a point in my life where it was very casual, and I was like in Converse and blue jeans, and I'd always wear a blazer, like a band T-shirt or whatever. And there was a conscious decision that I went through. And it was like one New Year's Eve, and I was like, I'm not gonna go out in public in my Converse anymore.
You're not gonna wear your wife's sweatpants?
I'm not gonna wear my wife's sweatpants. I'm gonna take a little bit more pride. And so I went out the next day. I set like this New Year's Eve. What are those things called?
The resolution.
The resolution, and it was like really like an intention for me. So I went into my closet. I took all of my Converse high tops. I put them in a bag, except for like a couple of pair that have been with me
since
high school. Yeah, and I got rid of everything. I donated all my clothes, and the next day I bought one pair of leather shoes. And then like 3 months later, I had probably six pair of leather shoes, and I had four jackets. And then I started getting into suits, and then it's kind of become my thing now. People expect
it is your thing.
I'm going to show up, and I'm going to wear a suit, and. You know, it's kind of like a trademark thing, but I do like it because I've noticed like in sessions that I do, I was in a session with Don Was at Capitol. Don Was and Ed Cherney, and I walked in like a full.
Can you explain to the people listening who Don Was? Was not was. Damn right, Emily, Google that shit.
Was not was. He's a massive record producer now. He's the Rolling Stones record producer.
You like the Stones, right?
I do like the Stones. Yeah.
I think they're a pretty underrated band. I have a feeling pretty soon they're going to break out.
I think that at some point they're going to probably, you know, have that one song that launches them for sure.
It would give me some satisfaction.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got no sympathy for the devil.
Let's just paint it black.
We could go on all day with this.
Actually, the entire rest of this show is brought to you by Stone song titles. No, continue, because my goal with being a music manager is to look like a slouch. Completely, and then deliver with emails.
Yeah,
I'm not. I'm kidding. I dress.
Well, your emails are dressed up.
Extremely dressed up.
They're
because Emily reviews them and yells at me.
Mm-hmm. That's a good thing. I think everyone should have an email reviewer.
I think everyone should have an Emily.
Get paid the big bucks.
You let me tell you something. If you looked at her 401k, you'd still be looking.
So I was in the studio with Don Was and Ed Cherney, and we were doing a big project for Motown. And it was literally like the best of the best of the best musicians in
the studio. Motown session people are. Holy shit.
It was insane. And, you know, I came in a total three-piece suit. And everybody in the room had said something to me at one point about what I was wearing. And the next day, two of the guys in the session musicians came in, and they were in blazers.
That's the lead by example thing.
And I was like, look at you. And they were like, well, you know, look at you. So it was like this really cool thing. And, you know, it's a respect thing for me. It's almost like.
Well, I do not mean to disrespect you.
Going to church. No, not at all. There's no.
Basically, for this position, when I come to North Hollywood, I used to actually style my hair every time I got here. And then I'd walk out after putting the headphones on my head. And you know sometimes how bedhead is good.
Yeah.
This is not good bedhead.
Well, see, Emily, what he hasn't told you is he's doing gay porn right after this thing, and he just needs to he needs the shorts to slide off.
No, they come off quickly. I am a huge gay porn connoisseur, advocate, much like Ted Cruz's intern. Not Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz definitely did not watch that.
Right.
I mean, no wonder you're so okay with coming to the Valley every week.
Dude, I just wake up every day in Canoga Park for some reason. No, and all truth aside, I am gay and married. So, Kelly, this is my official outing.
This is California.
I mean, hello, we're trisexual. I'll try anything once.
That's good. Never
Thank
heard
you.
That
David
one.
Bowie said it. Mm. David Bowie, I'm sure, liked the Stones too, due to his amazing cover of Dancing in the Streets with Mick Jagger.
Yes. You know, it's funny.
What?
That you just said that. I've got the Video Music Award presented to David Bowie for Dancing in the Street. I've got the Moon Man for the VMA. Yeah.
why did you give me a t-shirt and not a Moon Man?
It was a gift. I was recording a band and they came in and I have this I always have a giant altar in all of my recording sessions, and the altar keeps growing. It's just artifacts and Buddhas and just trinkets from you know, collecting over 20 years of memorabilia. And the band walked in and they were like, "We've got a present for you for your altar." And I was like, "Great, let me see. Awesome." And they pulled it out. It was like the Moon Man presented to David Bowie for Dancing in the Street.
I mean, that's dope as fuck. My buddy Daniel, you reminded me of something. My buddy Daniel Rubin, who was on the show, he's an artist manager, manages a band called I the Mighty, and actually a band on Epitaph, Too Close to Touch, and a producer. I know I'm wearing their shirt. Holy shit. You can't see this on the radio, but this shirt is very tight-fitting and looks like a suit. It's not. So at any rate, he manages a producer named Eric Ron, who's probably one of the top 10 rock producers in the game now. I digress. So he told me that what he wants to do is collect, you know, record RIAA plaques to engineers that he had nothing to do with. So it's like if you worked on Abbey Road and you were the engineer to George Martin, he wants that plaque.
Interesting.
So that's like kind of what you did, except yours was a gift, and we plan to break into houses and do it.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of breaking and entering, for sure.
Well, that's how Emily and I met as well. So anyway, let's actually talk about your story. So we all know how we both met. You were in yoga pants. I was in a three-piece suit.
Yep.
And that was dope. My
I look good in yoga pants, by the way.
I do not. So the thing is that you have been behind the scenes for a while, but I want to hear about what drew you to working in this crazy industry from either a young age or when you had your tipping point.
It's interesting. You know, for my entire life, I've never wanted to do anything other than music. And that's from the earliest childhood memory that I have. I know for a fact the tipping point for me when I was had to have been 5 or 6 years old, living in a trailer park in Lake Charles, Louisiana. I was watching The Muppets, and I was so fascinated with The Muppets. And when Dr. Teeth and the band would come on, I was just mesmerized. And I became just really obsessed at an early age with The Muppets and the songs and the artists that they had on. And
this is the Muppet Show, right?
The Muppet Show, the original. Yeah, because I'm a little bit older than you guys, but the original Muppet Show, and I just became obsessed with it. That is literally the earliest memory that I have. And then I started transitioning into my dad's record collection and listening to, you know, his Rolling Stones records or his, you know, Beach Boys was a
I just saw them, man.
Yeah, it was my first concert I ever saw.
Mine was The Who.
Nice.
What was yours?
Avril Lavigne.
You win or lose. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty dope. You know what? I'd see Avril now, but I mean, your first concert's pretty rad, too.
Yeah.
I saw The Who. One of my bands, Rose Hill Drive, was opening for The Who at the Hollywood Bowl. So my first time.
My eyes are popping out of my head. You opened for The Who.
First time ever seeing The Who. It was in my band. It was a band I was managing.
Still.
But first time ever seeing The Who, I got to go backstage, meet Pete Townsend, Roger Daltrey, the whole thing. And then I stood
Was he the dick you wanted him to be?
Everybody was great. I stood on the side of the stage and watched. But so I grew up in...
Was Richard Starkey drumming?
Yes.
Dude, that guy's a monster.
Amazing. Well, I met him as well. And he came up and...
That's Ringo's son, Emmy.
Thank you.
You're welcome. See, I this is an educational show for everyone in the room.
Mm-hmm. He was I met him. He came up and he had this great blazer on. And
you like clothing.
Yeah. And I noticed it and I was like, hey, that's a great jacket. And he was like, it was my dad's. And it was like one of the early Beatles that had like the high collar. Mm-hmm. It was
1964.
Like, yeah, it was like one of those jackets. And it was really cool.
That's when we were both born, Emily. We were both born in 1964. Oh, we're so draft Dodgers.
You guys are older than I am.
Yeah. No, come on. Okay, no, I'm 81 and Emily is late 90s.
Emily doesn't look a day over 15.
I get that so much. I really do.
So
I'm
when
20.
She's selling meth at the high school, yeah. She works because she looks like one of them.
That's how you do it, though.
Yep.
It's not fun.
It's camouflaging.
Yeah, up until this year, my license photo was from when I was 15, and no one said anything about it because I look like I'm 15.
You know what's funny is every time I have to take a license photo, I get something really strange done to my hair and intentionally, and I go in and I make the absolute most ridiculous face that they'll allow me to make. Usually it's.
I just made a weird face, guys.
Usually they'll do it two or three times. They'll make me retake the photo, but I've come out with some like really really terrible photo IDs.
Well, feel free to share with me privately or publicly.
Yeah, so have I, but mine weren't intentional. So.
Yeah.
Some people photograph really well with license pictures and not other places, and I'm raising my hand.
Yeah. I know girls that'll go in and be like,
"Can you retake
that photo?" Or can I just give you? Can I send you a photo and you put?
And the people there are usually really passionate about their jobs.
Yeah.
So right. I digress. Let's get back to Sears. You know what? Let's talk about the Pantheon. I'd say the person who works at a peep show, and then the DMV, and then Sears.
Yeah.
I just came up with that Pantheon, and I'm going to say Pantheon again just because it's an awesome word.
It's a great word.
So anyway, so we kind of jumbled it a bit, but you were into animals drumming, obviously, because dude's a beast.
Yeah.
So
Dr. Teeth was a big one for me. I think the whole band, you know, it was full of so many great characters and good songs, and then they had great guest stars come in and sing with the band.
A-list stars,
yeah. I mean, so that was... That was inspiring for me, and I grew up in a musical, very non-musical family, but it is a very musical family.
Louisiana is a musical state.
Well, my parents own a chain of music stores throughout the South now. My mom remarried. We moved to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I kind of grew up there. When I was in middle school, she started dating a guy that she's married to now. She's been with for 30-something years.
Mazel tov.
The guy in town who owned all of the music stores. He was like the cool guy. So I was big into music, and so as they were
dating,
you
got Animals 7-inch.
No,
Animals 7-inch is sick as fuck.
I've got Animal tattooed on my arm though.
You do? Let me see it.
It's up here. I'll show you.
Yeah, later. Yeah, because I am in gay porn, so I definitely want to see more skin.
So you know. I grew up, man, when I was my first job at 14 years old, 13 or 14 in the summer, was working at now my parents' music store. I started cleaning horns and things like that. And
wait, stop for a second. So it was a music store that sold actual instruments.
Yeah, okay. Instrument music store. And at that point, he had a chain. So he had two stores in Louisiana. He had one in New Orleans, or two in Baton Rouge, one in New Orleans, one in Monroe. So they were kind of all over. But at 13, 14, I started cleaning horns in the summer. By 15, I was working all summer at the store on the floor selling instruments. And I was just so passionate about it that I ended up being a really great salesman. And
you're also helping your family.
Yeah, I had some of the highest, you know, one of the highest sales numbers. It was one of the biggest salesmen at the shop during the summers. So, you know, all the way through high school, I worked at the music shop, and we did a lot of crazy marketing and promotion campaigns where I started this thing called Drum Wars and then Guitar Wars. And that was, you know, we would hold basically shows with, you know, musicians coming in and battling out who was going to win you know, the best drummer in, mm-hmm. in Baton Rouge or whatever. Right. So we did these whole things, and that really kind of like sparked a, you know, a marketing and promotion bug for me. And then I was always big into the artist. So when the artist would come in, it was different for me. So I dealt with a lot of, you know, customers that were coming in that, you know, their kids played
of all ages.
Of all ages. But then I'd get the artists that were coming in, and all of the artists were coming in to see me at one point. And I got into A&R, and that was through my parents' music store. So I started up our first A&R division, which was the artists would come in. I would get them deals with like Remo or Vic Firth or guitar strings or guitars.
These are music gear companies, Vic yes. Firth, and examples. Of, I'm not just looking at you and telling you. I'm looking at the collective audience.
I appreciate it.
Well, it's an informative show for those in the room, as we say, too. We're going to cut you off for a second and get to some commercials. And we can go more into Vic Firth and I guess your transition into leaving the music store business and entering the music business.
Perfect.
But, Emily, does your adjective remain the same for Mr. Jason Hollis?
Yeah, I think it's going by fast, going by quick.
Mine is insulting. That's the adjective that I would do. No, in all seriousness, it's passionate because there's some people that are behind the scenes in this industry that I feel are just behind the scenes in this industry, kind of like a 9 to 5, and then when they're done, they clock out, and I can tell you don't.
24/7, man, 365, that's how I roll.
Well, I'm 25/8, 366. How do you like that? One up like the that. Motherfucker.
I do like that.
Thank you. I worked really hard on that joke knowing that you were going to say that. So anyway, stick around for Waldman's Words with Emily Burke, Jason Hollis, and the guy wearing Adidas shorts in the corner named Scott. Hello. Welcome back to Waldman's Words with Jason Hollis.
Enough Emily. About you. Let's get back right back into me.
Oh, yeah. It's clearly been about me this whole time. No, normally I would argue.
Just get right back into it.
No. This is my show. 55% normally me, but I'm taking a seat back, and I'm saying you're a fucking talker. So I'm going to let you do your thing because you like it, and you're good at it, and you don't stammer, and you articulate, and you don't use the word So, Emily, before we get back to the guy who's going to be doing the majority of talking, mm-hmm. how you feeling, girl?
I'm feeling good. I do say the word though.
I wasn't going to point that out.
Yeah, but you're the editor, so you can edit them all out.
That's true. I control the show. Fun fact, pulling the curtain behind the scenes, guys. That's what the show's about.
So when you hear any awkward pauses, it's like, so you realize that Emily edited her arms out. So anyway, you worked in the music store biz. You were cleaning flugelhorns. Then you sold it all, and you worked in A&R there.
Yes.
When did you actually leave the nest?
I left the day after I graduated high school, the very next day. I'd been planning my move to Los Angeles since I was 15. And I'd you know, saved up money.
Well, you're a salesman, so you made some money.
I probably made better money working at my parents' music store than I did in the music business.
Teaching guitar lessons.
Yes, right.
Music business is stupid. Anyway.
Yeah, I left the day after I graduated high school. I started planning my move at 15. So by the time I came out here, I had an apartment. It was paid for. And I could just kind of like really settle
what year
into
was that?
1993.
So rent was significantly less than.
Yeah, my apartment was $495 a month.
Can you please be quiet right now?
And I lived on
like a king in Bel Air.
I lived right off of Sunset Boulevard on Larrabee in West Hollywood.
Oh wow,
amazing!
That apartment right now is 5 or 6 times the cost.
Yeah, 1,200 or 1,500. Yeah,
it's stupid,
and it's a studio.
Oh my god! You know that people complain to me about the cost of living in LA, and I agree. But New York laughs at us.
Yes,
and San Francisco laughs at New York.
Yes, they do. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
And we laugh at Baton Rouge.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, there's so much more. I think, you know, here's the thing. Nowadays, people, when I was coming up, it was almost like you had to move to Los Angeles or you had to move to New York if you wanted to be like an artist or a painter. We didn't have the internet. You just knew that this is where industries were.
Tastemakers.
Nashville was country music. You knew that. You knew Los Angeles was rock and roll. You knew New York was like R&B or whatever it may be.
Urban.
Artists. Yeah, urban. So you had to literally, you know, you had to move. Now you don't have to do that. That's the beauty of like the internet and social sharing and things. You can you can live in a town that will support your artistry because it's much cheaper to live there and get your content out to the world. So, I mean, we're definitely making strides. I would recommend anybody moving to a Los Angeles, California.
Well, you want more meetings with more like-minded people in cities like LA, New York, and Nashville, but it's true because of the internet, because the ease of literally right now, the level playing field, all three of us could record a song today, post it on the internet, and we all have the same opportunity for views.
Absolutely, or start a show, create your own series.
You mean Waldman's Words, which you're tuning into right now?
Yeah. Ding. So, you know, you don't have to live here. I mean, when I moved here, it was one of those things where I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I wanted to make records.
You mean produce them?
I wanted to produce records.
Right.
We didn't really even have recording studios. You know, the closest one was in, I think, New Orleans at that time. And it was just, you know, it was local. I wanted to make records. So my plan was to move out here. I moved out here. And I quickly realized that LA is a big place. And
I thought you were going to say bitch.
It's a very unforgiving place. And it can be quite mean. And, you know, coming out here at 18 years old, you know, leaving a smaller town, coming out here.
With a more familial base, though. Like, I mean, you probably knew your neighbors there.
And yeah, I knew everybody. I moved out here and I had no family. I had no friends. I just moved. And I came out here. I worked under Tony Zetlin for a couple of years, and I worked under a couple of promoters and marketers, and did some cool projects. But inevitably, Los Angeles was a little too big. So I stayed out here for my 2 years. Once my apartment was up, I moved to Nashville, and Nashville was a bit more condensed. It had all of it had the record companies, it had the studios,
the songwriters,
had everything there that I wanted to learn. So I moved there, and I was there I cut my teeth in Nashville for 7 years, almost 8 years. Broke my first a couple of artists, made my first records. I worked with small acts, big acts, and learned that I was going to go fully independent in Nashville. So Nashville taught me a lot about the music industry, and what it did was it prepared me to go out on my own.
Well, as we talk about the cost of living and all these places and the three major music hubs of LA, New York, and Nashville, I've had two separate private conversations this week with people that were moving from LA or New York to Nashville because it's definitely becoming more present. And while you're in Nashville, I believe, are the Pink Spiders from Nashville?
Yes, yes. So I started working with those guys while I was there. They were actually one of my first bands that when I went out independently on my own, I'd been working with Matt Bell since he was 16 or 17. He was in a band called Silent Friction. And we were working.
And his name is Friction, right?
Yeah. And so we were working.
Mind blown.
We were working together. All the way up until when I left Nashville.
Can you describe, though, the intricacies of what you did when you were working together? What does that mean?
It was really artist development, management stuff with Matt. It was kind of like working with him and developing his songwriting and really just it was mentoring. I had a studio. We recorded his band. I tried getting Silent Friction signed to a label. That kind of didn't work out. But it was. I believed in Matt. He was a great songwriter. And it was just one of those things where he and I we connected on kind of like, I'm going to help produce.
A big brother type
relationship? It really was more of a mentoring thing. And coming from someone being on the business side and an artist. So it was kind of it started really early on with a kind of a management.
What do you find is a big difference between artist development and management?
There's a really big difference in my opinion. I think nowadays managers have to understand the art of artist development in order to be good managers. But, you know, when you look at old school artist development and you look at like the Ahmet Artigans, the Andrew Lou Goldhams, you look at people that are literally seeing into the future. They can visualize. They understand where an artist is and then where they can be. And it's the development time in between finding a band like or a guy like Matt Friction and Silent Friction.
A little rough around the edges, but has a lot of potential.
Correct. All the way up through the launch of the Pink Spiders, which garnered one of the biggest record deals in the 21st century.
Or ever.
And also changed the way that contracts have been written from our contract that we signed with Geffen. So it's the in between. It really is the development of looking at the branding side of it, looking at the development side, looking at the songs, looking at the production, looking at the style, looking at how we're going to market,
Do your own
promote.
Social branding with your outfits too, so you're familiar with marketing yourself.
Yeah, well, it's being an independent person, you come up and you have to learn. I was telling Emily earlier, it's like, one of the reasons for taking on an artist, especially being young and coming into the business, is you learn these skill sets that no record label is going to teach you, no management company is going to teach you. You learn them on your own because you have to go do it. And, one of the big things, one of the reasons I've stayed independent for so long is I don't believe in being compartmentalized. I don't believe in compartments. I don't believe in the marketing division, the promotion division. I believe that
it's one-stop shop.
To be successful, you have to know everything about all of it, and you have to be pretty good at all of it. Then and only then can you start bringing people in to help you. You can look at like the big picture of it, and you can kind of steer the ship. But
well, true CEOs, like I go to Warped Tour every year because either one of my bands is playing, or I'm playing, or I'm working, networking and all that stuff. And I see Kevin Lyman picking up cigarette butts.
Yeah,
like the true people, like the big CEOs or the people that really succeed, are the ones who know every single facet.
It's lead by example, and when I was coming up in the music business. It was a very different time. If you wanted to make records, you had to go intern for, 2 years, a year, 2 years.
Doing the shit of the shit.
Doing the absolute crap. But the way that people took note of who you were was how good you made coffee, how, attentive you were to the details.
How reliable you were.
But not only that, like the toilets, that was a big thing. Like, can you keep a fucking toilet clean?
Emily, I promise to never ask you to do that.
And Thanks. You know
I'm
what?
I'm no longer an intern.
Oh.
The thing is like, if I have to go clean a toilet right now, I'll go do it. There's nothing
You'll
beneath
do it.
Me. And the thing is like, I'm going to clean the fucking toilet better than you're going to clean it. I can guarantee that. It's a race for me. It's a competition. And I had that attitude coming up through the industry.
No job is too small.
People took notice of that. And I started getting little tiny breaks here and there. And within those little breaks, it just kept becoming, I had more and more breaks. One of the things that really drives me a little crazy about where we are today within this
Is it
going to
be the entitled generation?
It's not an entitlement. It's the fact that when I was coming up and we were having to do these jobs, and literally, you would some days you would work for days, 3 or 4 days. If an artist was in there and they were, blowing through, lots of drugs in order to keep them going, you had to stay on that pace and work. I didn't ever call myself a record producer. Because I value that title so much. I never called myself a record producer until I was officially paid on my first job to produce a record.
Well, we're in LA, man, and obviously people call themselves producers or managers.
It's not just Los Angeles, and this is one of my kind of, things with
But what I was saying was is just that there's a lot of people that like kind of appropriate the title without justification.
I think that, but I also think that what it is like I've worked with artists in the past, and these artists they're not. First of all, some of them can't even play an instrument. They definitely can't write a fucking song
or sing.
They can, the ones that I work with, they've got some type of talent for sure. So usually they can sing really well, but they can't play very well, and they can't write a song for sure. But what I found was these people. Being the singer, being the artist, it wasn't enough. They wanted to be the video director. They wanted to be co-producer. And then they wanted to have writing credit on something that they didn't write. And that bothers me a little bit about the industry. Not to complain. I just think that people need to be aware that
a lot of people rant on this show. It's all good.
You have to, you know, there is when you earn things and you work your butt off to earn a title, it makes it that much more, you know, important, I think.
Well, it's justified. Emily.
It is justified.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about this often on the show. Do you find that a lot of people of your generation misappropriate?
Yeah. I think especially when you come with, like, the music producers. If you have a garage band, you're a music producer, you know?
Yes.
Or an iPhone.
Yeah. There's so much crap out there.
Which, listen, it's great. And I think that...
You mean the option is great, but the title
isn't. The technology is great. And if you're a guy and you've got GarageBand and you're at home and you're hashing this thing out and you're cranking every day and you're putting stuff out on SoundCloud and you're putting content out there, then that justifies itself. I'm just talking about there's, you know, I think that with a title... You know, you have to be careful with titles because everybody wants a title nowadays, and I never want a title. I want to be able to earn a title. So when you get that title, it comes with a
real
level
of respect. The fuck they want
you can call me any. I'm called probably horrible things on a daily basis.
As soon as you leave, that'll happen.
Yeah,
but
sure.
we have a few more minutes, so let's talk about Punk Aristocrats. But for the record, I love the Pink Spiders, and I think it's dope that you were affiliated with them, especially during the most pivotal part of their career.
It was a fun time. You know, it was one of those things where you only read about bi-coastal bidding wars, and you read about this craziness that happened in like the 80s and even early 90s. It was still going on. When in the early 2000s, that stuff was really...
It was more DOA.
It was not around that much. But the fact that we did what we did, you know, at one point, you know, my first Lakers game was sitting on the floor seats next to Ice Cube. You know, that was part of our wooing. Finals.
Yeah.
You know, they Geffen Records shut down Magic Mountain for 2 hours on a Saturday morning so we could go, and we opened the park and we had the entire park for 2 hours to ourselves. It was insane. We jumped on a private jet. We went to New York.
The dinners were my favorite part as
the
an
dinners,
artist. Oh my God.
We sat down, you know, with one of the president of a label, and he was like, "You guys want drinks? Everybody want drinks?" It was like, "Yeah, let's get some drinks." And he looked at the guy and he said, "Bring us everything on the menu." And it was just like, it was insane to go through that. And, you know,
is that what made you a punk aristocrat?
No. I think that, you know, I was
sick transition, right, bro?
Oh yeah.
I was very against. I was very against a lot of the things that the record companies were doing back then, because to me it was like such a waste of money. And there's money that you can spend in better places than, you know, spending $5,000 on.
Dude, we got a 25K marketing budget when my band, The Sage Drive, was on Columbia. I have no idea. And we played Warped Tour at the same time as Pink Spires, actually.
Yeah.
And I have no idea where that money went.
Yeah, well, it goes really fast. And
it goes up the nose really fast.
I like longevity. I like thinking, like, how can we have an artist around for, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now? So I'd rather spend money on, you know, the artist development side, then we have to have a hit single or, you know, the thing is shelved. But yeah, Punk Aristocrats it's always been my Punk Aristocrats is a name that I came up with, that it was just cool. It's like the juxtaposition of being a punk and an aristocrat. And it was my, my production company. So it's all of the productions that I was doing independently, they ran under Punk Aristocrats. It was the way that I was paid for a long time. And then I went to a buddy of mine and I had him design a logo for me. And we did this bulldog wearing a top hat. And I started putting the bulldog with the top hat out there and kind of branding it a little bit different. And it started to take on a life of its own. People were getting the bulldog logo tattooed on their arms and legs and backs and hips.
I just have unwanted body hair.
I mean, yeah, well, we should probably have it, you know, like where they wax it. You could wax a bulldog.
Wax makes me break out, dude. Let's talk about something else. Okay.
I like
sorry.
How you've tried.
I've tried.
Yeah.
Tried so hard and got so far. Anyway.
So the logo and the name just started to take off. And
it's catchy, dude.
And people were getting it tattooed. I was started throwing parties. And then I started releasing my own content with bands that I'm either producing or working with or that you like. Yeah, and
it's kind of like this show. It's people I like.
Exactly.
And I just drooled.
And you have to go out there and produce what it is you like now, because there's just so many various outlets of monotony that we need. We need lots and lots.
You mean
good
quality content?
Quality content everywhere. Amp Radio, one of them. So 2 years ago, we started Punk Aristocrats Radio 1, and that is like, it's just growing and growing and growing and growing and growing daily. Like, I think last month alone, we had 10,000 plus listening hours, which...
It's a good number, man.
Really great.
You're in the five-figure digits.
For a month of, you know, people listening to
How can people tune? Because we're cutting this off soon. How can people tune in?
Sure. It's punkaristocrats.com. Everything's there. You can listen. You can stream live. You can download the free app for iOS or Android. If you've got music that you want us to listen to, you can send it to social@punkaristocrats.com. If we like it, we'll put it on the radio. We'll promote it. We'll put it on our Punk Aristocrats TV. We've got lots and lots of eyeballs coming through our website daily. And I like to promote unheard of music. I find music from all over the world that I like that nobody else is playing. So I just, it's my outlet.
You're giving an audience, man.
To be able to program and put stuff out there that I really like and bands that are hustling and up and coming. So it's all happening right there. Well, we just launched our first single last week. From a band called 42 King, and the song is called Over My Head. That's our first single that we've just put out, and it's great, man.
Well, this show has been great. In addition to your own socials, to close this out, I just want to give your daughter a shout out for having the coolest Instagram of someone under the age of 18.
Strummer Hollis, yeah, she is
at Strummer Hollis.
It's at Mason Strummer is her Instagram. She's rad. She's named after Joe Strummer from The Clash.
I've heard of him.
So she's got rock star blood in her. She's grown up in recording studios and around rock stars her whole life. So she's kind of, you know, led a privileged life.
London Calling in Los Angeles.
Yes, absolutely.
That's my favorite Clash record. Anyway, talk about your own socials, how people can check out what you're doing. And
I'm pretty easy.
I know that.
In so many more ways than you know. I'm at It's Hollis, and that's basically everywhere. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, all of them. At It's Hollis, and then at Punk Aristocrats. Those are all of the channels that I'm on daily. And like I said, if you're a new band and you want to get heard, send me your stuff. We'll check it out. If we like it, we're going to play it. It's simple as that.
That's as simple as it technically gets. So thank you. Another fist bump.
Yeah, man.
Emily, adjective.
Great.
Adjective with actual great tone.
Great.
Thank you. Here's my adjective, informative. Thank you very much. You know your shit. You love your shit. And for some reason, you don't go to the bathroom. So I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, man. Let's do another 25 minutes. Let's go.
Well, unfortunately,
I've got a bar to get to. So
you have a bar to get to. I have a bar to get on. So Waldman's words. Who are the next few guests, Miss Burke?
Oh, we have Chris Foytel.
Yeah.
We have Dave something.
We've got Mara Schwartz Krug.
Yes.
We've got Ben Farber.
Ben Farber and Dave Bogan.
Yeah.
There you go.
So thank you, Emily, for being rad as fuck. Thank you, Jason, for
thank
being
you
fuck
guys.
As rad.
It's been fun.
I learned a lot. Stick around for Waldman's Words every single Tuesday night, 5 p.m. Pacific time. If you're in LA, you'll be in traffic. Listen to it on the Adobe app or on the interweb, 8 o'clock Eastern time while you're watching reruns at 90210. And on Sunday mornings, wake the fuck up and listen. Or just go on iTunes and download it. Emily, you're great. Jason, you're great. Bye.
Bye.